The following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang. Yes, what time it is? I'll tell you. It is time for the True Wealth Show on this biggest Tuesday you've had a week. Today, we got a studio full. We got so many people in here that it is really warm.
Ow.
Yes, that is how warm it is. Of course, you got me, Dave Littlejohn, joining me also.
Matt Dixon.
And.
Derek Simmons.
And. Blake's off camera. But we're glad we got everybody here. Got an interesting show here today, don't we?
We do.
That's what I'm hearing.
Yes. We're going to talk today about, this one's a fun one to me, right? And I'm going to try to make it fun for everybody else. Like, are your investments boring enough?
Right now, I like that from
right? You're like, wait a second. How are you going to make this show interesting if you're talking about boring? Just, you got to stick with me on this one. Matt and I were talking about this. We were talking about the fact that it's been a really wild year in the markets. Right.
If you've been measured, a wild 2 years.
Yeah, it actually has been a wild 2 years. And we're starting to hear some things just percolating. Mm-hmm. And this is not the first time in my career I've heard this kind of thing. And where folks are looking at the returns of two of the key indexes, right? The favorites being the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, and talking about, well, look at how high the returns are. And then they're starting to compare themselves to those indexes and saying, hey, should I be investing more like that?
Mm-hmm.
Should I be in an index fund?
So that is not actually the question that's being asked. That's a great question.
Okay.
Right? It's a relevant question, and we can certainly discuss that today. I think it's disguised that way. Right? I think it's disguised as, should I be in an index fund? But the trick is that a lot of people, say, 6, 8, 12 months ago, didn't like the S&P 500, right? And now, lo and behold, folks are saying, hey, I like it now. Why don't I go get it?
You're referencing that 20% pullback we had, like, not that long ago, right? I think you said 6 months.
Yeah, not even
real.
The 20% per se that, the pullback was one thing, but now that it's up, that's the issue, right? Everybody's saying, like, it's kind of like saying,
they're like,
well,
I want that.
Why can't I go? Why, let's go buy Nvidia,
mm-hmm.
right? Or these are the people that today say, well, let's go buy Tesla. And I say, I hate to break it to you, but you know, you're pretty late to the party, right? I have a really stupid analogy for hot stocks. Okay. Hot stocks are kind of like a college rager. Like, it's a big party, right? At first, people haven't heard about it. And then the people start showing up and it starts getting a little noisier. Before you know it, it's getting noisy enough that the people that weren't invited start crashing the party. And then everybody's hearing about it and it's going crazy.
Then in Yogi Berra speak, nobody goes there anymore because it's too crowded.
Nope. Then the cops get called.
You're right. It's a really terrible analogy.
Yeah. The cops get called and people start getting in serious trouble for it. Now, the folks that do great are the people that were there pretty early. And then right about the time the cops get called, they jump out the window and run and they get away. But there's not that many of them. And some people jump out the windows and get hurt. But, you know, the question is, if you were in the middle of a rager of a party and it got too crowded and you just left and then the cops got called after you left, all right, good for you. But now, how many investors show up to the party right about the time the cops are getting called?
A lot. Because they look at how much fun everyone else is having.
That's kind of the issue. Now, if you're not a partier, I realize this does not have nearly the same impact. But I think everybody kind of gets the generic idea is that there was a point at which it was fun, then there's a point that it got out of hand, and then there's a point that it came back to hurt you,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's kind of how really risk, high risk investments can be like that. But
right.
The problem is there's a psychology to investors that gets wrapped up in this too. And the truth of the matter is it's hard to watch something go up and up and up and up and not want a piece of that action.
It's true.
Right? And so today,
and you never hear news about it having gone up and up and up until it already has. And then it's intoxicating.
Yeah. Right now it's like, come on, well, why didn't you buy Bitcoin when it was 4 cents?
Mm-hmm. And lately it's been everything to do with AI. Yeah. If it has AI behind it, it's like, buy that thing, right? Because surely it's going to go up.
Yeah. I mean, everybody knew that Apple was going to, oh, wait, that almost went bankrupt. Right? I mean, Apple was around in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you buy it back then?
Right.
Oh, it was kind of a mess, right? Why didn't you buy more Microsoft? And maybe you did. Like a handful of people were like, oh, I took it to the bank. I'm like, good, you're the exception. Right? That is not how most people played this game. And the truth of the matter is you didn't have to play it that way to be a successful investor. But it lulls us into that, right? Mm. This game of comparison. And so we're going to talk about that today. There are all kinds of psychology studies about this. Now, don't worry. I'm not going to leave you in a position where, great, you told us all these problems. What do we do? Now, we're going to talk about some of the ways that we can protect ourselves as investors and make better decisions. But we got to kind of unpack a little bit more about how this works. So first, I want to talk a little bit about the concept of the psychology curve for investors. Mm. You've seen this one, right? Matt, have you seen the roller coaster graphic?
Yeah, it starts out when you're kind of optimistic, right? And you want to get in. So you're optimistic, you're excited, and the stock market can be thrilling for a lot of people, right? And you get in and maybe things go well for a little bit and it's kind of euphoric, right? And so everything feels great. But eventually, you know, the tides kind of start to change. Maybe some stocks are peeling back a little bit. And now you're getting a little bit of anxiety, denial that it's happening.
And then you sell and the price goes down even further.
Right.
It's terrible.
If it were that easy, right?
No, yeah. That's what I'm saying is you're on the downward curve and you sell to cut your losses. And that happens to everybody. And the stock goes down further. It's not that it's easy. It sucks.
Yeah. Well, and
don't sell when it's going down. Wait, I know that's your line, but still.
So it is a really interesting thing because we run into the issue of, are you buying something or are you renting something?
Mm-hmm. That's really the question, because sometimes people, they're just renting it because they don't actually believe in it. They just want a return.
Yeah. So I want to draw a little different definition around investor versus trader today, and we're going to talk about that more throughout this show. The idea that investors buy investments, right? They buy things with the expectation that they're going to improve and increase in value. Okay. Traders are not buying based on the idea that something's going to improve. They're buying based on the idea that the position itself will simply change in price. And so they're going to take advantage of the price change. They don't really care what drives it, right? They just, now they may have theories in the short term if somebody says, well, I'm going to buy something because it's going to report on earnings tomorrow, right? But still, what they're expecting is some kind of short-term change in the supply and demand dynamic of the marketplace. And they're looking for a directional movement to capitalize on. And it's not a long-term deal. Like a trader does not buy something and say, 10 years from now, this is going to be a great trade.
Very few people do, right?
That's some of what we need to talk about. Because the question is, why do so few people think that way?
I think it's because largely people in their nature are impatient, right? They want to be successful right now in the moment. Mm-hmm. And they want to look good every moment of every year. But what happens when people think that way? They often get greedy and they chase stuff.
And I think there's nothing wrong with being a trader. You just have to know it's way higher risk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of understand that, like, don't show up to a basketball game wearing football pads, right? Mm-hmm. Different game.
Right.
And so they're not built to be the same. And so you would not expect to play the game the same way. And trading and investing are not the same. But it's sneaky because you know, you could be buying the same instrument, but you're not doing it the same way. And I think there's something really critical to understand. This show is really designed for investors. That's mostly who we are talking to as investors. Doesn't mean that we've never talked about things that are tradable events or market moving events that would talk about the short term behaviors of the market. But that's who we're talking to. If you're a trader and you're listening to the show, doesn't mean it wouldn't even be interesting to you. But you probably know more about trading than I do. Or maybe not. But, you know, we don't trade for our clients. That's an individual practice, right? But
I had this discussion with my brother over the weekend. We were talking about cryptocurrency, which I know is a topic you guys have hit on a number of times on the show.
Sure.
But he was saying, I was saying, look, I don't understand it. What I do know is that it gets its value. Well, no, my understanding is it gets its value because we all agree it has value. But that's not that much different than U.S. currency. It has value because we agree it has value. In theory, it's backed by the government, but past that, it's the same thing. And he said, yes, but when you're buying stocks, you are buying a representative share of the assets.
It's true.
Which is investing, as opposed to I'm buying something that people agree has a value, I'm waiting for it to change in value, and then I'm going to sell it, which is totally trading. And yeah. I say there's nothing wrong with that. He just couldn't wrap his mind around the fact that you might trade something you did not understand.
Okay. This is such an incredible segue. We didn't even set him up.
This was almost our show today, actually.
You kind of nailed this one. Here's what we got to do, all right? Because the timing is perfect for this. You just said something super important. We need to unpack this more for our listeners. This concept of how many people will trade something they don't even understand. The question I'm going to hang you on is, does it even matter? Do you need to understand it? Okay, we'll talk about that and more, but we're going to grab a break first. So stick around. When we come back, all that good stuff and more. But we got to take this very important proper break. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And Derek Simmons.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon
and
Derek Simmons.
And you can get caught up by checking out the podcast. It'll be available tomorrow at littlejohnfs.com. Today, we are talking about whether or not your investments are boring enough. And we've already kind of we went down this path. And Derek, will you remind our listeners? I mean, you said something really important right at the break. You just had a conversation with your brother.
Yes. And we were talking about whether it makes sense to invest in something that you don't understand. And I think the distinction is maybe not. It doesn't make sense to invest in something you don't understand. It might make sense to trade something you don't understand.
Okay. And let's help our listeners understand, because we've been sort of dissecting this a little bit, the difference between investing and trading an asset like that.
So what we were talking about was if you are going to trade, it makes a lot of sense to understand what's causing people to trade in it. If there's psychology behind people buying and selling, even if you don't understand what the asset is, it makes sense to know why they are buying and selling.
I think of trading kind of like a lease, right? Or maybe even like an Airbnb versus buying a house. You don't have to know a whole lot about the market or anything if you're just trading it, right? You can just show up, have it for a few days or a few weeks, and then you walk away from it.
Yeah, it's a fun analogy.
Right? But if you're going to be investing, you kind of need to know more. It's almost like a long-term purchase of a house or something.
Here's the question. Did this conversation originate around cryptocurrency?
Cryptocurrency, yeah. Well, that's not where it originated,
okay. But
it went there because it's a prime example.
Sure, sure.
And it was actually an example of what I was telling him my investing strategy is. Are you ready? Is everybody going to lean in close to the radio?
Yes, I'm right here.
Yeah, go on.
I don't worry about it. I pay you guys to worry about it.
Yeah, you've officially outed yourself as a client, but I didn't.
I'm putting money in, and then I expect that you're going to worry about what it is we're buying.
Right.
And when it's appropriate to sell, and you're going to put appropriate stopgap places to buy and sell stuff. And that frees me to do things that I'm better at.
Yeah, which, of course, that's... Thank you. It's a kind of a cool endorsement when we're talking about, and this will come back into the show to be relevant. You know, we talk on this show to everybody, right? So whether you're a do-it-yourselfer or you're somebody that's going to hire a professional, and even if you're going to work with somebody else besides us, we're trying to give everybody that opportunity, like a bite at the apple, if you will. Like, so everybody, I want you to kind of take away some things here. But I love what you said about this, Derek, because I mean, the reality is from a pure return on your time, if you're looking at where can you best leverage your capacity to create more wealth, your time value is much better spent in your profession than it is trying to learn my profession.
True. And as a, when you're speaking about the time value as well, my event horizon for needing this money is retirement. So it's not like I need it next week. If I need it next week, I'd be on you guys a lot more about, you know, what are we trading? And what's a short-term gain?
Right.
But and it's off in the future.
And we're going to come back to that as a concept. We're going to if you want to wonder, stick around. That comes in the fourth segment. Okay. Then the fourth segment, we're going to talk about a couple of key things. And I'll just give you a hint. It's sort of like the milk bucket. Okay. Maybe not the milk, just a bucket. We'll go with that. But I like this concept of time delineation, very critical. Okay. Understanding how long you can afford to have something invested. So let's talk for a minute about Warren Buffett. Okay. Matt, this is something that when we were prepping for the show, I know you did a lot of work on this. Can you explain, like, for our listeners, when I bring up Warren Buffett, why do we want to use him as an example today?
Well, I think it's because everyone kind of knows who he is, right? Like, if there's one person in investing that you've probably heard of, it's likely Buffett, right? And so everyone hails this guy as arguably one of the greatest investors of all time. But what I think a lot of people overlook is that there was a series of years where, by all metrics, you know, he was underperforming. And there was times where people were throwing him under the bus saying this guy's washed, right? It happened in the 90s, right before the dot-com bubble. It happened in 2018, 2020, during the COVID era, right, when everything was going up because they were printing money. There was a lot of times where Buffett didn't look great compared to maybe, say, the index. There was a 10-year stretch where he underperformed for 10 straight years. And so everyone likes to say, you know, at certain times, this guy doesn't have it anymore. But if you look at things over a super long period of time, from the 60s until now, he's way outperformed the index. So it's a matter of when are you measuring this guy's success? Because if it's over multiple decades, the guy looks really smart. If it's maybe a single decade, maybe not as much.
I think that's really important to understand because it ties into your point, Derek, right? When you talk about time, the question is, when does the investment really need to be there for you?
Mm-hmm.
And what is the job? One thing that I've always appreciated about Warren Buffett, and I don't know that we get the same luxury in the financial professional arena when you're talking about advisors for people, and I'll explain what I mean, but Warren Buffett has pretty much said, I don't care what the index does, right? I don't care. If you don't want to invest with me, don't. And his shareholders have really got this message because the Berkshire Hathaway loyalists are exactly that, right? They're, hey, we're long-term investors. We buy and hold this stuff. We're about owning good companies. We're not renting them. And so they're willing to tolerate the ups and downs of the market in the short term.
Yeah. Okay?
Now, why do you think that I say that for a lot of financial advisor types that this is not necessarily the same circumstance?
Well, they're graded on a calendar year basis, right?
Yeah.
Or less.
Yeah, sometimes less.
And that's the reality is that the clientele, because of the psychology of chasing performance, will hold their advisor oftentimes accountable on a shorter time horizon, even if they're looking longer term. Right. And that's a tricky deal, because on the one hand, an advisor's trying to encourage folks to stick to your plan. But on the other hand, you've got folks saying, figure out how to generate performance right now, or I'm going to go somewhere else.
Right. I want more. I want more. I want more.
Yeah.
I do. I want you to beat the market in every single time period and over every single day. So, you know, go. Yeah.
And the truth of the matter is, so do I. Right? but realistically, that's not going to happen.
Win and never lose.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we're looking for. Is I would like you to bat 1,000. I would like you to always win. And I'd like you to always outperform. And I say, and I like to ride unicorns. Right? I mean, it's just not realistic that can happen. And in fact, if it were happening, you would question how that person was cheating.
Right.
You might be okay with it, but at some point you'd assume like the law would
Did
keep
you
up.
Sell your soul?
Yeah. At what point do you say, like, how does Biff Dodson always get every sports call right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I had explained to my daughter yesterday what Back to the Future was, at which point I felt even older.
Have you trapped them and made them watch it?
So I've attempted to do this. They're very wiry, so tricky to pin down.
Mm.
But at some point it'll happen. I think I just need to secretly Velcro them to the sofa. But I don't know that that's up to fire code, but it would be effective. So anyhow, back to the conversation that is, right? The time horizon is really important. That's why we bring this up, right? And so investors get tempted into this thing. Have you ever heard it said that comparison is the thief of joy?
I think I have, and it makes a certain amount of sense.
Right.
I've got a great family and a lovely house, but if I look on Facebook, I'm getting my ass kicked.
Yeah, everybody seems to have a better life than you on Facebook,
yes.
Right?
Right.
Until you meet them, and then they go like, ha, no, I'm miserable, right? No, comparison is the thief of joy can also be a really tough mistress, if you will, in the investment landscape. Because if you start with one idea in mind, and then you start watching something else, then you get tempted to chase that direction.
Well, and people that chase, I think there was a study on this, right?
Yes,
and they
there
were
was.
Saying like the average investor that chases performance tends to underperform by like what, 3 to 4% annually?
Which is massive, considering that if you did nothing, you should be able to get about 4% in CDs right now.
Right.
So you've basically taken your safe rate of return and thrown it out the window by chasing.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot.
It's a lot when you consider the compounding effect of that. If you mm-hmm. lose 4% per year, it gouges your ability to compound assets.
Yeah.
So that's a really expensive penalty to pay. The question really is, like, what does this look like? How can you give me some examples of how someone might chase returns and what tends to
Yeah, ring works? Ring ring. Hey Matt, I saw Nvidia's way up and I want to get in on that train, right? So let's just do it. And it's like, well, is it still time, or did it just run up 100% this year?
Yeah. Or what I hear right now is ring, ring, ring. Hey, I hear that the S&P 500 is up like 14% this year. Why don't we go buy that?
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And you go, so, hey, you know, when we talked about how you like to invest and what kind of risk taker you are, you said, you know, you couldn't really tolerate more than a 7 or 8% pullback in the markets. But that would really freak you out.
Yeah.
Right? And you know that the S&P 500 can have 15 to 25% pullbacks. Like that is historically yeah. not untypical. Like, yeah, but it's up 14% right now, and I just feel like we're missing out. So are you telling me that you're now willing to accept, instead of a 7% drawdown, a 20% drawdown in your account? I said, well, let me kind of give you something as we like land into the next break here. This one I want you to chew on. The idea that on the way down, people measure absolute returns, but on the way up, they measure relative returns, right? Percentages on the way up, dollars on the way down, right?
Yep. You know,
hey, I lost $10,000, okay? Was that a lot? Well, yeah, I had $20,000. Yeah, that's a lot, right? No, I had $1 million. It's like, that's a rounding error.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I had $1 million, I lost 0.1% or whatever it is for, you know, your... for $10,000 loss. It's just not gonna ruin you. But that's relative at versus absolute. And so, hey, I made the S&P's up 14%, I'm only up 12. It's not enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, right? But on the downside, so I want you to think about, do you do that? Ask yourself that question honestly. How do you measure your gains and losses? Okay. And what are you comparing that to? Is it to your plan? Is it to an index? Is it to a number?
I feel like this is a great question we should ask Derek when we get back from the break, because, you know, we do this all the time for a living.
Well, we're
He's the investor.
So
we need to ask the investor.
I'm going to ask everybody. So we're going to go to break, all right? So when we come back, I want you to answer this question in your head. So that's cue the music, Kyle. We've got the question I want you to ask is, how much should a candy bar cost? Okay? You pick that number in your mind. When we come back, we're going to ask Derek, how much should a candy bar cost? And I'll explain why.
Snickers or a payday?
Yes. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And Derek Simmons.
And you got True Wealth. On News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where we are covering some ground today. So if you are just joining us, grab the podcast. It'll be available tomorrow at littlejohnfs.com. And really, you should, if you listen to podcasts, you should just subscribe so you get it all the time. But I got two ringers in studio today. Of course, my main man,
Matt Dixon.
And my other main man,
Derek Simmons.
Okay. And Derek, of course, is one of our favorite attorneys in the entire universe and a frequent guest when we can get you. So I'm excited to have you today.
It's good to be here.
So we have been talking about, and I asked everybody at the break, how much does a candy bar cost? Now, you should have had a number in your mind.
Almost.
Yeah.
You asked how much should a candy bar cost.
I was going to say, how much should a candy bar cost?
Yes. Okay?
Now that is different. You know what it costs, but how much should it cost? Right? So now let's start with you, Matt.
Yeah.
How much should a candy bar cost?
Should be like $1.45, but lately they've been like $1.70. So
okay. And so the answer is Matt's wrong.
That is correct.
Derek, how much should a candy bar cost?
It should cost 25 cents.
25 cents. Okay. That's even better, right? Because I think it should cost 40 cents. I think they should give them to me because I'm worth it. But really, I think the price is 40 cents and everything above that is just highway robbery.
And if we asked Blake, she would ask us, are you buying or selling? I understand.
Or she would say something like, no, I'm not going to have that candy bar, but I would like this other thing, right? So the question then is, why should a candy bar cost 25 cents?
Because that's what it costs when I was a kid and my parents bought one for me.
Okay.
We couldn't get it unless we had the 25 cents.
Right.
A quarter was a nice round number. There was no sales tax at the time in that particular state. It worked really well.
Right. Matt, why should it cost $1.45?
I feel like that's the price it's been most of the times I've went to buy a candy bar. So I'm like, well, if that's the baseline price, that feels like a decent
Matt
value.
Matt is also 6 years old, so... I couldn't resist on that one. The reason that you have a number in your head, most of the people listening to this show are not in their 20s. Okay. Those of you that are, congrats. You're going to be smarter than the rest of us. But for a lot of our listeners, you guys know what I'm talking about. That was the price when we were a kid, right? 25 cents. There's some people that are going, are you kidding? It should have been a nickel, right? To which I say, high five. I still like your price better than mine.
I do remember when penny gumballs went to 2 cents. No, they went to 5 because you couldn't put 2 cents in the machine.
Yeah.
It went from 1 cent to 5 cents all at once. And the 70s were ruined. I just remember this.
Yes. It's sort of like a funny but true story recently. I was in the dollar store where things now cost $1.25 a lot, but some things cost $1.50. And you realize that they were able to increase the price by 50% overnight. Once they broke the $1 and they wanted to sell,
there's
up,
nothing holding them down.
It
nothing
can be
at
anything
all.
Now. The dollar store, it could be whatever.
We will sell you half a golf ball for $1.
The funny thing about it is I had this moment. Now, I don't make recommendations on the show, and that's not what's happening right now. But I did have this moment that occurred to me. Think of the margins they could reclaim because they've completely shattered the price anchor point for all of the people now. And because they can move it so much so quickly, right? They can reprice by 25% by moving it a quarter. And I thought, huh, well, that's an interesting investment thesis that they could radically change their margins on the product. Of course, it's a little bit of a failed or incomplete thesis because I have no idea what the supplier's charging them. Right. Well, so they may not actually have that much margin. They probably have a different price of inventory than they did as well. So I don't know that it's really that linear, but it did was an interesting theory in my head. OK. The point of the Snickers bar or the candy bar exercise was the concept of anchoring bias. OK. You realize as investors, we do this all the time. Right. Mm. I mean, when you make an investment, if you go out and buy a stock and it's $100 a share and you buy 10 shares of it, how much money did you put into that thing? $1,000. Right. Now, if it goes up by 20%, OK, you're going to go look at the share price and go, look at that. It's $120 a share now. And so you made a 20% profit on your $1,000. Right. If it goes back down, here's the question. Are you still profitable or did you lose money?
Depends on how far it went down, I guess.
Yeah.
It also depends on how you anchor, right? Some people anchor to the price they paid and some people anchor to the highest price they've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's the thing I always look at. When I go to look at my investments, the individual underlying stocks, I look at the price we acquired them at. And that works really well unless I bought it more than once. And
right?
Then I can't tell.
Multiple lots. It also works pretty well until you've owned it for a while. Because if you've owned it for multiple years, you have to start looking at it and comparing it to your opportunity set and making sure that just because you're profitable doesn't mean your rate of return is very good.
Yeah, if you're up 8% over 10 years, it's like...
Yeah.
Right? And so, well, it's more than I started with. It's got, yeah. Well, if that's all it takes, then guess what? You're not comparing to much other than your acquisition cost.
Yeah.
It's a low bar to achieve for an investment professional, so they love you, right? But it may not be a great mechanism to
right.
achieve profits.
Where if you could have gone and bought treasuries and got 30%, it's like,
right.
well, you kind of...
Right.
Risk a lot more for a lot less.
Yeah. So I think there is a couple of things that investors ought to think about. One is, what's the rate of return that you need?
That's the biggest piece. Like, I feel like people listening to the show need to hone in on that part of the show.
Yeah.
What you just said. How much do you actually
explain
need?
This for our listeners, Matt, because we talk about this a lot.
Right. Well, I mean, part of it is looking at, you know, what does it cost to float your lifestyle, right? And how much do you have? And then kind of reverse engineering it, right? Like, what type of rate of return do I need to average in order to keep my lifestyle afloat? That's part of it, right? And then so for some people, that might be like 10%. And it's like, ooh, you know, like maybe you need to take a little more risk in order to keep up with your spending habits.
Okay. So expand on that for our listeners. What do you mean take a little more risk? Like, why is that relevant?
Right, because oftentimes, you know, risk and reward go hand in hand. If you're not going to take any risk, you wouldn't expect to be paid a lot of return, right? Versus the person who takes on more risk, you would expect to get a higher rate of return over time, because why else would you be willing to take that type of risk?
Yeah, you ask questions in a different order, not how much money do you have to invest. It's where do you want to be? It's
where do you want to be?
And then you back into it. You say, well, we're going to have inflation and we're going to have various things. And then you assume a rate of return. And then you say, does it get you there?
Mm-hmm.
And then if it doesn't, then you say, well, if we need to adjust our rate of return to be higher, we have to take more risk.
Yep.
And it's possible that it ends up being lower.
It's true.
So it's a risk-reward sort of a decision.
Yep.
And one of the things that I find is most important is to ask it periodically. And if you don't ask with a goal, you're never going to get there.
Yeah. This is why planning typically goes hand in glove with investing.
Right.
If you work with a professional, they are very often going to try to encourage you to engage in some form of planning, even very lightweight planning. Lightweight meaning you don't have to get into the hyper-specifics of tax rates and all of the idiosyncrasies that come with that. You just need to have a sense of what's your future lifestyle likely to cost. And then with that, you can do some reverse engineering. But the reason it's relevant is because, yeah, why invest taking more risk than you have to?
Right.
Okay.
One, it changes year to year. What if you had, you know, your investments and they went up 20% in a year and you're in retirement? Maybe you know, your accounts grew so much that you don't have to take nearly as much risk the following years.
Yeah. Here's where I like to point people to is it's great if you're willing. Let's say you can afford to take more risk.
Okay? This now, is that's a completely different situation.
Yeah, you have enough assets that you say, well, even if I lose some, I'll still have plenty. This is the case for folks oftentimes where they have a pension income. So, mm-hmm. Well, I live off my pension and my investments are really just to grow. And so I don't have to take money out of them. Very well. Then you can afford to take more risk. The question is, should you or do you need to? Mm-hmm. And some people are okay with it, right? They just said, no, you know, I it's interesting to me. I'd rather do it this way. And so, yeah, let's go ahead and let the markets do what they do. Okay. But for folks that maybe can't afford that risk because they don't have a pension as a base level of financial protection, then you're sort of buying your own level of protection, right? And in that case, I like to talk about a concept that, at least in our office, we call it the personal index. Okay? So the personal index is, and I'm going to just, let me give you kind of a quick primer for this one, and then I'm looking at the clock and realize we're going to have to jump onto our last break. But the primer on the personal index is simply what rate of return is required to reach the lifestyle design goal that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if I need to make 6% per year in order to hit my target, and I'm less than 6%, then I'm underperforming my personal index. I'm going to have to make some adjustments.
Right.
But if I can achieve higher rates of return than that, then I'm in a zone where I'm above where I need to be. So I'm sort of in the safe zone to achieve the lifestyle I'm targeting. Right. And so that means I can either afford to adjust my risk even lower because now I'm further down the path and I've earned ahead of schedule, or I have to adjust potentially to take on more risk if I'm behind the power curve.
Yeah.
Right. So that is part of how you have an adaptive process. It's built on your personal index. And what that also does is it can help get you sticking with your investment plan rather than chasing returns. Okay. Really important stuff here. So as I look at the clock, let's do this. Let's grab our last break. When we come back, I promise you we talk about buckets and how that can help for investor psychology. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And Derek Simmons.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM at 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show on the home stretch here, where we have covered some ground. You can get caught up at the podcast. It's at littlejohnfs.com. If you go under the Knowledge Center, and you'll see podcasts under that drop-down menu. Anyway, I've got Matt Dixon and Derek Simmons in with me, and when we left our listeners, I promise I talk about buckets. Okay. Matt,
yes.
Probably more so you than Derek. Any idea what I am talking about?
Yeah. I mean, it's this concept of like, hey, what if there's this bucket of money over here that's pretty conservative and that's where you go get cash when you need it because it doesn't have a bunch of huge swings. And then you've got another bucket sitting over there where it's like, I know I'm not going to touch that money for the next 10 years. Let's be aggressive with it. And then you can kind of fill in the blanks about that middle bucket, right?
Yeah. So here's the truth. What we're doing is managing investor psychology a little bit. Now, here's a newsflash. How many people that listen have heard of Dave Ramsey? Right? And most of us raise our hand. He's famous for the debt snowball,
mm-hmm.
and which is what? Right? You pay off the smallest debts first and go from smallest to largest. That's not the most financially, like, the cheapest
productive.
Way to do it. Yeah, that's
the most
not.
Productive way would be to pay off the highest interest rate yeah. first.
Right. So why would he possibly say such a thing?
Because he wants people to feel like they finally
it's
had a
It's psychology.
Yeah.
If you knock one off, it's off.
That's it, right? You need some wins to stick with the program. If
yeah.
it takes too long to see a win, it's just like weight loss, right? A lot of people give up on weight loss because it takes too long for the mirror to start showing a difference. right? It's just frustrating, and so people quit on it.
Well, and exercise is hard.
Exercise, there's a lot of reasons, right? But you get the idea. So the issue with investing is, in truth, all of your money spends the same, right? A dollar spends the same, whether it's in your savings account or your checking account or your retirement plan. However, there's different tax treatments and whatnot, but it doesn't really work to try to insist that everybody think of all their money in one big bathtub, right? It just doesn't work very well. So the bucket strategy can be useful if you're just, you kind of need to know how you work. And what you're doing is saying, well, if I put some money in a bucket here that I know I can get to at any point, what I've done, and this is also why emergency funds exist and so forth, I've bought myself time to let my investments ride through choppy markets. That is the point, right? And so your like emergency fund is supposed to usually be 3 to 6 months. Why? Because that way you don't have to liquidate your investments during a big market pullback.
Yeah, you're not tapping into your 401k.
For people that like raided their retirement plans at the bottom of COVID, it's like, I'm not working right now and I don't have any income coming in and I need money. So they raid their 401k. And what happens? They take it out at the bottom of the market where they get the least value for their investment and they pay a tax penalty on top of it. It was like getting punched in the face twice, right? The whole purpose of the bucket strategy is to buy you time so that you can afford to let your investments wait out a cycle that's adverse.
Yeah.
Okay. And so we talk about money that's like emergency funds, intermediate term money, long term money. And that long term money, if I could convince more people to work this way and say, well, this is your 10 year money or 10 years plus, you could be a lot more like Warren Buffett, right? You don't have to measure quarter to quarter and compare yourself to an index unless you are buying the index, right? And the truth of the matter is, Warren Buffett has a really great quote, not intended to insult anybody either, but it's so telling. It says, index funds are protection against the ignorance. That's what he says. An index fund protects you from ignorance. You go and you buy the market, because if you're not a professional investor and you don't know how to spot things that are going to be good investments, quit trying to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And just buy the index because it's a pretty good formula.
Right.
Right? And so you get the market. And historically, the market has done pretty well. But who's done better over their lifetime? Warren Buffett or the S&P 500?
Try annualized returns of 19.8% versus the S&P at 10. So almost double.
Right.
And it's because he missed a lot of the downside.
Yeah.
Right? And if you look at total return from 1965 to 2023, Buffett did 4.3 million percent returns versus the S&P at 24,000%.
Which is still
staggering numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still not even sure that's right. But I don't care. It's the point is that Warren Buffett has crushed it. And this is the idea of compounding over time. I'm going to leave you with one last thought around this issue. And then I'm going to do something unorthodox on the show because I've got all of your attention. Right? I'm going to remind you, losses hurt more than you realize. Because what happens is losses are not the same rate. They're not ratio metric. If you lose 10%, you don't need 10% to make it back to where you started, right? $100 loses 10%, now you have $90. If $90 earns 10%, you only have $99, right? So you need more than 10% to dig out. And the deeper you fall in the hole, the harder it is to crawl out, right?
Yep.
If you lose 25%, you need about a 33% return to climb out of it. If you lose 50%, you have to double your money to get back to where
you started. Right, and that's kind of a wild thing to think about given where we are even today, right? You look at price-to-book ratio of the S&P, and it's higher now than it was during the dot-com bubble of the 90s.
The price-to-book, that is just a valuation form,
right?
We're not talking about volatility per se, but I think it's that warning that if it's really expensive, volatility could sting you, meaning the markets may be expensive today, and if they pull back in price, you're just in time to buy in at the highs and experience a drawdown. Now you got to wait to dig out of that
cash
hole.
Cash isn't always a bad asset.
It's not. So in the final minutes, I want to do something because I think that we've kind of drilled into this show pretty well. All right. If you want to try to figure out how to do this in your own investment world, what I'm going to tell you is keep learning. If you want to work with a financial pro, find one you like and trust. If you don't have one, give us a call. Mm-hmm. Right? How do they reach us, Matt?
Yeah, 541-375-0898, or just go to the website at littlejohnfs.com.
All right. And you can also email us. You can text us at that number, but all that information's there. We have the internet. It's cool. Now, in the final, like, 90 seconds or so, Derek, I want to give you a chance to plug something really fun. You were doing something really fun in the community right now. Can you talk about that for a sec?
Shall I speak in my French accent?
Oh, my goodness.
I can try this. Yes, I am a cast member in the Steve Martin play that is called Picasso at the Lapine Agile, and it is, which means like restless rabbit. But it's Steve Martin from Saturday Night Live.
And fun.
Parent was at Cheaper by the Dozen and a number of other movies. But yes. Anyway, right now, Murder in the Buildings. But the most important thing is that this is UACT, Umpqua Actors Community Theater. And so it performs on Harvard. And we've got all community cast members, and this play runs in the first 3 weekends of September.
Okay.
It's going to be fun.
It's I've had just sneak previews of conversations and things. It sounds like it's going to be fun and pretty funny. I mean, Steve Martin.
It's Steve Martin. No
so
doubt.
That's really cool. Also, I think it's fun that you're here. Little John Financial, we sponsor UACT as well. I know you're a sponsor, but you're also a participant in it.
Right. It's fun.
Right. If you've never had a chance to check this out, it's actually a lot of fun. Right. So this is one of those where I'm going to say, go invest in your local community theater and enjoy a play there. It's really cool. And yes, you get to speak in a French accent the entire time.
The whole time.
Okay. And yeah, it sounds totally natural.
Almost like I've been to France.
we joke. This is actually Derek's normal voice. He's been speaking in English the entire time.
And I do a fairly good job of improvising.
Well, we're out of time for now, so we're going to sign off. Until next time, I'm Dave Littlejohn.
Matt Dixon.
Derek Simmons.
And we'll catch you later.